I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to the From the Vaults Rugby Podcast. My name is Phil McGowan, and this World Rugby Museum podcast will explore some of the greatest players and moments in rugby's long history, featuring first-hand witnesses, commentary and interviews with the people who shaped our sport. In the wake of the stunner in Shizuoka, we will be interviewing England coach Eddie Jones about exactly how he took the Brave Blossoms into the top 10 of world rugby and inflicted possibly the greatest sporting upset of all time when Japan beat the Springboks back in 2015. Eddie, first of all, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us. Your first experience of a coach in Japan was back in 1995. What was it like?
It was very interesting. Firstly, you get a cultural shock from just the country, and then the rugby culture is completely different from anything you experienced before. The first team I coached was Tokai University, which was a struggling first division team in one of the Kanto leagues in the university. And I went there as the head coach. And as soon as I got to training, I was informed by the director of rugby that the captain had controlled the session and he'd tell me what to do. So that was a bit of a shock. And after 2 weeks, I remember being at training and not doing much. And, you know, training would generally go for 3 hours, be completely non-specific to the game. So the only way I could change that was by offering my resignation. So I offered my resignation and the director of rugby then allowed me to start running the sessions.
And what was your average training schedule like?
We had a squad of 90 players. So they normally trained together, as I said, 90 players for 3 hours. So I broke it up into three squads, made training much shorter. So I used to run basically from 4 o'clock to about 9 o'clock, three different sessions for the A, B and C group.
From there, you went on to coach Brumbies in Australia. Did you always expect to go back to Japan?
Yeah, well, I always wanted to go back to Japan. During that time, the first year I coached Tokai, I was also forwards coach for Japan. A good mate of mine, Glenn Eller, was recruited in 96 by the head coach, who was a guy from Suntory who loved Australian rugby. And you've got to remember, in 95, Japan was beaten a record score by the All Blacks, something 145-3. So they wanted to change their rugby, so they employed Glenn, and then Glenn got in contact with me. We were old mates. So we coached Japan together for 96. We ended up winning the Asian Championship, which is the first time Japan had won it without foreign passport holders. So I always saw the potential of Japan as a rugby nation. So after I left in 96, I continued to go back and do part-time work for Suntory, which I still today have an association with. And I always wanted to go back there and see if I could develop that potential, that inert potential that was there in Japanese rugby to its fruition.
Japan in the 1960s and 1970s developed a very unique way of playing, which was successful up to a point. Was that something that you were aware of and you wanted to bring back?
100%, yeah. What's old's new? I remember playing in 1978, I think it was. I played for New South Wales Schoolboys against Japan, and Japan were tiny, but they scrummed this low from the ground. played quick channel one. Their lineouts were all short lineouts. We couldn't win the ball off them. You know, we ended up winning the game easily. But at set piece, we could not win the ball off them. I could never work out why Japan went away from that, because basically what happened was there was, post 95, there was an influx of New Zealand coaches and New Zealand players, and the Japanese adore the All Blacks. You know, I've never seen so many All Black jersey than you see in Japan. And what happened was that the Japanese wanted to copy the New Zealand style of play, so they went away from all their strengths. And basically what I decided to do when I went back to Japan was to concentrate on their strengths and then develop their game from there.
And were you aware of those great players like Demi Sakata, Seiji Hirao, that Japan had produced in the past?
Definitely aware of them, met them. I can still remember Hirao scoring a fantastic double-round try in 95 against Ireland at the World Cup. And again, that was an example of what Japanese could do. And those old great players were always around, always chatted to them when I went back there.
What about the rugby community in Japan?
Well, there's a very strong rugby community in Japan. It's very small and very networked, but very strong.
How did the opportunity to coach Japan arise, and when did it come into view for you?
Well, it was a strange set of circumstances, actually. I came here to coach Saracens and signed a long-term contract anyway. During the course of the first 6 months, the ownership of Saracens changed, and I really didn't like the direction it was going, so we wanted to move, and we wanted our daughter to go to a place where she could finish her high school. So we decided to go back to Japan, and I took over the job as coach of Suntory, which hadn't been doing very well. Was successful there for 2 years and then took over the national team in 2012.
And what were your immediate ambitions for the team, and how far did you think you could take them?
I remember the first press conference, I think, talking about the fact we wanted to get in the top 10 in the world. And most of the people in the room looked at me as though I was crazy. But I really felt there was that opportunity to get in the top 10. And by the World Cup in 2015, we ended up, I think our highest ranking was 9th.
I think you reached the top 10 in 2014, didn't you? And you had some big victories over European opposition in 13 and 14.
Yeah, we got a lot of confidence from that, beating Wales once, beating Italy once. Going to Europe in 2013 was the first time a Japanese team had ever won in Europe. So there were some good milestones along the way which helped build the confidence of the team.
And how did you go about embedding that positive culture and cycle of improvement?
Yeah, well, one of the things I did when I went back there, I got a friend of mine to do a research paper on samurai culture, because I wanted to understand what was the real pillars of Japanese society. And there was three things that came out: discipline, hard work and respect. So they became the three values of the team. And then we decided, right, we've got a small team. How can we be better than the opposition? So our set piece had to be innovative. So we went back to playing channel one. We went back to playing quick lineouts, winning the ball in space. We had to be fitter than the opposition. So we ran the ball, tried to run the ball from everywhere. You know, the ball was a moving target. That was our theme. And then defence, we wanted to make sure we chopped tackle, because we were small. So it was pretty simple. It was pretty easy to come up with a game that I felt suited the Japanese. And once we started winning, the players started to believe in that style of play.
So you focused on culture rather than looking at the individual skill sets of players?
More about the culture and obviously the physical size of the players. You know, we had small players. But I always believe that when you go to a country, there are certain values or certain behaviours that are indoctrinated in the players and in the society, and you've got to stick to those. And if you go away from those, it's hard to get a connection with the players and the team.
And what were your thoughts when you saw the draw for the Rugby World Cup?
I'd coached South Africa, so I knew what a physical, committed team they are. And, you know, they've always been a good World Cup team. But what I thought, if we can do well in that first game, then it'd give us great confidence to go on in the tournament. And what traditionally Japanese have done in those games because they hadn't won a game at the World Cup for 24 years. And every time they played against a tier one country, they'd basically surrender. So they'd pick their B team and save their players for the rest of the tournament. So we had the completely different approach. We were going to put in our absolutely best team, prioritise that game, give it everything we've got, and then we'll worry about the rest of the games after that. And so once we got the draw, we set about devising the game we thought we could beat the Springboks, and we practiced that consistently for about 2 years. On the morning of the game, I remember going down to the beach with Michael Leach, and we were having a chat about the game. I just remember saying to him, just give it everything you got today. You know, don't be afraid to lose. And, you know, the fantastic decision he made on the field to go for the scrum, which could have, in fact, lost us the game, when we could have had a more than honourable draw, was a testament to his belief in what the team could do.
Save the try. Patakawa. Murphy! Here we go! Hiscott! Come on, Hiscott!
When did you mentally accept that winning was a possibility?
I thought we could get to 60-minute mark and be close. That's my most honest answer. Because I thought if we could get close to 60-minute mark, then the pressure on South Africa then would be enormous, because they'd be looking at the scoreboard and thinking, it's not supposed to go like this. And so we'd have an opportunity to win the game.
Who would ever have predicted this?
The crowd will tell you again. Delirious. Very good, the Japanese lineup.
I didn't believe we were going to win the game until the ball was dead. But there was, again, in the game, we scored a try, I think, early, a more try early, and the score for Japan to score a more try against South Africa is quite unique. So I thought, oh, we're going to make a good fist of this game. We're not going to be embarrassed. Because you've got to remember, their average result against a Tier 1 country at the World Cup before that was 85-0. So to get in the game early, score a try, put some pressure on, showed that we're in the fight. And I remember thinking at one stage, I almost felt satisfaction there, which was the worst thing to feel as a coach. But then got myself back on track of how we're going to win this game.
To steal the game for Japan, one of the most famous victories in the history of sport, I'd go as far as saying, not just in the game of rugby union.
Our eyes have seen the glory. It's a rugby miracle.
The players were absolutely ecstatic, and it basically took us 2 weeks to get them back on track. That was difficult, and we had a game against Scotland 3 days later. You know, and so our focus had to turn to that Scotland game. Now, in retrospect, I'm disappointed the players couldn't enjoy that result as much as they probably would have liked.
Tell us a bit about the Scotland game. 3 days, really fast turnaround.
Yeah, again, so we didn't have great depth in the squad. You know, we had 25 good players and then probably five or six players that weren't at the level to play. So a lot of our players had to back up. I remember leaving Brighton, and, you know, the whole town was so excited in Brighton about our victory. Long bus trip up to... We stayed in Warwick, had a couple of days preparation, and we were right in the game. You know, I think we were ahead 15-10 after 50 minutes, and the number 8, Nucky, was playing superbly. He got injured and we lost a lot of momentum. They got one or two things right, gave them a lot of confidence. They got energy. We started to drop off, and, you know, we got beaten, I think, 40 to 20. They were too good for us on the day, so we didn't have any excuses.
And after that game, you'd won one, lost one, still very much in contention to qualify. What was the preparation like from there?
Well, I always remember about... We had a long break. We had probably 10-day preparation for the Samoan game. About 3 days into it, I had to pull the team in and give them a bit of a rev up, because they were sitting in the team room watching NHK television or Channel 8 television, watching... television shows about our victory. You know, they were still basically playing the South African game. So we had a bit of a change of mindset, and the players applied themselves really well. And our probably most complete victory at the World Cup was against Samoa. Tactically, we were brilliant. We closed them out. You know, a side that's athletically gifted against a side that's not athletically gifted. We controlled every aspect of the game, and I thought the boys were superb. But then the next game against the USA was probably even more of an achievement for the team, because our dream of making the quarterfinals had gone. So we were playing just for pride, and the USA had targeted that game as the game they wanted to win, and we just stuck at it and did enough in that game to win it.
And do you think that's a blueprint in the Samoa and USA performances in terms of how Japan should approach the next World Cup?
Yeah, well, Japan has to be tactically smart. You know, they're never going to be physically the best team in the world, so they've got to play fast, play to their strengths, be very skillful and be tactically smart.
Japan are the only team to have won three pool games and not qualified. How disappointing was that for you and the team?
Not really. We weren't good enough. You know, if we were good enough, we would have beaten Scotland. And that's, if you want to make the quarterfinals, that's what you got to do. So I didn't have any regrets or was disappointed. We gave it everything we got, and I think, you know, that team can look back with great pride on their performance.
And what was the reaction like in Japan when you got back?
Oh, it was crazy. It was crazy. Everywhere you went, there was just crowds of people. I can remember meeting Michael Leach for a coffee in Shinjuku, and we came out of a Starbucks there, and one person saw us and took a photo, and then it ended up, it took us 15 minutes to get out of the shop. Michael Leach had a cafe out at Fuchu. He was getting people lining up 3 or 4 hours before his cafe had opened to get in. You know, it just became rugby was the fashionable thing. You know, Goro Maru became the most consistent performer on commercials over there.
And Japan are about to host the Rugby World Cup for the first time. How significant an opportunity for rugby in Japan is that?
Oh, I think it's going to be the catalyst for the game to kick on and be a really consistently strong sport there. Because the big thing for Japan to flourish as a rugby nation is that at those younger age levels, kids are motivated to play rugby. You know, a lot of the mothers, particularly in Japan, don't like rugby because it's a physical contact sport, and generally the ground conditions aren't very good to play on. So you have to present a reason as to why kids should play rugby, and having a successful World Cup and a successful national team gives kids a dream. You know, they can play international sport at the highest level, doesn't matter what size you are. So that's really important for the future of Japanese rugby.
All right, there's a lot of rugby fans from all over the world about to visit Japan. What kind of welcome should they expect?
Oh, it'd be fantastic. You know, Japanese are very welcoming people. They'll be delighted to have such a big tournament. It will be unique because it's not a rugby country.
Thanks for listening to From the Vaults. If you're not already, please follow us on at W Rugby Museum at Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Sign up to our blog, also called From the Vaults, on WordPress. And more importantly, come down and visit the World Rugby Museum here at Twickenham Stadium. Please subscribe to From the Vaults for regular content like this.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.